Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as politicians of both parties and pundits of various ideological stripes discuss which services and rights need to be cut and stripped from working people, the subject of raising taxes seems taboo in corporate media discussion. Not so here. We'll talk about raising taxes with Chuck Collins, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging. Also on the show, it's not the corporate press keeping the story of Wisconsin alive. People in this country and around the world interested in knowing what's happening at protests in Madison and elsewhere and what the underlying issues are have choices beyond the elite media, many of whom are producing the sorts of stories Scott Walker brags about. How are independent media coming at these events differently? And doesn't it underscore how much we need them? We'll talk to author, activist, and Grit TV host Laura Flanders about the role of the non-corporate press. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Another week, another misleading attack on public workers from USA Today. The paper's made something of a staple of articles like March 1st's, which alleges that public workers in Wisconsin earn more than private sector employees. This is despite the fact that such a finding is at odds with much of the research on compensation. Under the headline, "In Wisconsin, Private Sector Pays Less," reporter Dennis Cochon says that, quote, "Wisconsin is one of 41 states where public employees earn higher average pay and benefits than private workers in the same state," close quote. Cochon gets to that by using the same fundamentally flawed analysis as in his previous efforts to paint public workers as overpaid, efforts which go back at least as far as 2008. Namely, he doesn't control for type of work performed, experience, or education. He acknowledges that, but he never explains the value of an analysis that requires you to believe that teachers and fast food clerks ought to get exactly the same pay. An economist is quoted near the end saying the analysis is misleading, but USA Today's thrust is clear. Economists don't know how to evaluate compensation as well as they do. They just don't give readers any reason to believe they're right.
Let's start with the assumption that creating jobs is a good thing. So how do we do that in the United States? ABC World News launched a series called Made in America on February 28th, and the point, driven home over and over again, is that if Americans buy more American-made products, we would create new jobs immediately. Here's reporter David Meir and anchor Diane Sawyer.
Economists say if we spend 1% more than what we're spending right now in American goods, we could create 200,000 jobs immediately, which is why we're doing all this.
That's 18 cents a day.
18 cents.
To create so many American jobs.
The next night, Sawyer was reminding viewers that if they just spend $64 a year on U.S.-made goods, they would create 200,000 U.S. jobs. As a demonstration, ABC went to one family's home and removed everything that wasn't made in America. No surprise, the house was mostly empty. ABC then attempted to replace all those appliances, toys, and furniture with goods made in the USA. And after a lot of work, they were mostly successful. The segment's patronizing tone is galling by itself. It also points up the inescapable problem with ABC's formulation. Why is it up to consumers to encourage the growth of American manufacturing? As ABC showed, buying U.S.-made goods is quite difficult. Is that because consumers decided en masse that we preferred our furniture made in Thailand? Of course not. Giant corporations did that, and for obvious reasons. Cheaper labor, which means they make more profit. ABC itself, of course, is owned by a corporation, Disney, famous for relying on overseas labor. So will ABC talk about that part of the Made in America story? Or what about corporations and corporate media's promotion of free trade pacts, which would also seem to be crucially relevant? The answer is, not so far.
A new CBS New York Times poll finds strong public support for public workers. For instance, 60% of those polled said they opposed stripping public workers of collective bargaining rights, and 56% opposed cutting pay or benefits of those workers in the name of deficit reduction. Some conservatives charged bias, but Fox's Bill O'Reilly helpfully suggested the remedy to the problem. Union households shouldn't be included in polls. As he explained on his March 1st show, quote, "The New York Times headline today reads, 'Majority in poll back employees in public sector.' But the poll is misleading because 20% of the respondents say they are from union households. If you subtract them, those who favor cutting benefits win the poll. Wow, New York Times." Close quote. So those with an interest in an issue should not be included in polling on that issue. By that logic, pollsters would have to avoid polling seniors on Social Security and Democrats on Barack Obama's performance and policies. But wouldn't that also require disincluding the wealthy and corporate management types from polls about taxes or worker concessions? And Republicans, wouldn't they have to be avoided in polls about, say, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's performance, like the recent CBS New York Times poll that O'Reilly was talking about?
The battle raging in Wisconsin is one of the biggest stories in the country, of course. Not too surprisingly, there's no lack of voices in the corporate media supporting Governor Walker's attempts to, among other things, strip collective bargaining rights from public workers. The same cannot be said for union representatives and supporters of the workers' cause. In fact, it wasn't until after liberal blogs discussed the lack of labor voices on the Sunday morning chat shows that one of the four, NBC's Meet the Press, included one union leader in its lineup. Just as revealing was what happened when AFL-CIO Chief Richard Trumka appeared on the show. Trumka cut against the grain, arguing that Wisconsin workers were underpaid and that neither their wages nor their pensions had caused the state's budget crisis. He pointed out that the governor was moving the goalposts, increasing his demands after workers agreed to cutbacks in their health care and pension benefits. And he pointed out that the governor was delivering an unfair ultimatum to workers. As Trumka paraphrased the deal, "You either have to give up your rights or you have to give up your job." While the argument apparently sparked Meet the Press anchor David Gregory's corporate journalist survival instincts, as he responded with a right-wing talking point about unions raising money from members to fund political causes, asking Trumka, quote, "Isn't this the cycle that we've gotten into that the public unions have to take some responsibility for?" Close quote. Of course, corporate officials are much bigger players in the game of funding political campaigns and causes. But don't look for Gregory to put the same question the same way to a private sector CEO, even though he talks to so very many of them.
And finally, "Teachers wonder why the heapings of scorn," is the headline of a front-page New York Times March 3rd article. The article by Tripp Gabriel reports, quote, "Education experts say teachers have rarely been the targets of such scorn from politicians and voters," close quote. Politicians, sure, but what's the evidence that voters, in other words, the public, have been heaping scorn on teachers? Gabriel offers nothing to substantiate this claim unless you call references to online comments and placards of counter-demonstrators and the assertion that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's teacher bashing has made him a national star substantiation, which you really shouldn't. By the 14th paragraph, Gabriel suggests the public's anger may be receding. He cites polls showing majority support for bargaining rights, as well as showing that people think public employees' compensation is either about right or too low, as, quote, "signs of a backlash in favor of teachers," close quote. But is it a backlash or the way people have felt about teachers all along? The piece isn't unsympathetic to teachers, but by buying into the notion that there is a wave of anti-teacher sentiment sweeping the public, it only emboldens teacher scapegoating politicians. And how about a little context? Journalists interested in scorn heaping could look at the Gallup poll from late last year that asked how people viewed the honesty and ethical standards of various professions. Elementary school teachers' ethics were rated high or very high by 67% of respondents. Newspaper reporters by 22%.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
There are some dumb political realities you just can't ignore. For instance, we are living through a demand-starved economy that cries out for more spending, but all politicians and pundits can seem to talk about is cutting spending. Whether the subject is the federal deficit or state and local budget shortfalls, the discussion usually comes down to spending cuts. Spending cuts that almost always demand that workers sacrifice services, rights, and economic standing. And all this while Wall Street salaries, bonuses, and tax cuts for the wealthy again rocket into the stratosphere. The seldom mentioned 800-pound gorilla in the room is raising taxes, particularly on corporations and the wealthy, a subject that our guest Chuck Collins has been talking about for some time. Take two, some time. Collins directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies and is co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging. Chuck Collins, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, would you agree that the subject of raising taxes is fairly unpopular in our national media discussions?
Yes, it seems a bit off limits. Seems like it's sort of one of the great taboos right now.
Well, we're told regularly that the U.S. has among the highest corporate tax rates in the world, so why raise taxes?
Well, the U.S. corporate tax rate is actually statutorily high, but effectively it's very low, meaning the corporations use a lot of loopholes and ways to reduce their actual taxable income. You're right that the whole debate seems to be looking at the spending side, whereas we've kind of been leaving the barn door open to all this revenue loss, as well as just not raising taxes on those most capable of paying.
I want to suss out that the difference between our effective tax rate and the tax rate that's on the books. What is generally the tax rate on the books for corporations, and what do they actually pay?
It ranges from 15% up to 35%. That's the actual rate, depending on the size of the corporation. What we find is that the large Fortune 500 companies, because they use overseas tax havens to sort of move their profits around, have very, very low effective tax rates, closer to 15%. And some of them obviously have paid zero taxes for years because they've made very effective use of tax loopholes.
Well, you mentioned that in your piece on the Huffington Post. Let's have a sampling of some of the corporations that you actually talk about in that piece, how much they actually pay in taxes.
Well, there are a number of corporations, that if you have $10 in your pocket, Steve, that's more than they've paid in taxes over the last couple of years. So Bank of America, Wells Fargo, ExxonMobil. A recent interesting example is Boeing Aircraft. Boeing hasn't paid a dime of federal taxes for the last 3 years, but just got a huge federal contract for $35 billion to build planes. So you see companies that have effectively gamed their taxes down to zero, and then there's a number of, like General Electric, who pretend that its subsidiary in the Cayman Islands is where all their profits are being earned, whereas all their losses are taken here in the United States. So their taxes are very low here in the U.S., and the high income and profits that they've earned overseas are not taxed because those countries do not have corporate tax rates.
And yet, as you point out, they enjoy a lot of the public works and services and protections that we have here that we all are basically left on the hook for.
Yeah, just imagine, ExxonMobil around the world, our military troops are defending their property rights and assets all over the world, keeping shipping lanes open. And yet ExxonMobil is paying nothing, zero, zip, for the fundamental infrastructure and military and support and education system and all the property rights protections that they enjoy.
Well, as little as we hear about raising taxes in the media debate, and as much as the pundits might object, as it turns out, the people favor raising taxes to balance the books, as a New York Times poll recently made crystal clear. Do you see this really coming into the political debate at all?
I do, because one of the things that people in the abstract are not that excited about government, but when they start to see the things that they need go away, or they start to see the real impact of budget cuts, they realize, oh, government is all around us and we depend on it, and these are my neighbors whose jobs are being laid off, and these are my children who are losing their teacher. So it starts to get very concrete and real. And I think that people don't buy this austerity story. The main story in the media is one of austerity. Where are we going to cut budgets? when in fact there's another story, which is what happened to the revenue? Where is it gone? Why can't we find it? And I would liken it to a village on a stream where each year the water flow in the stream gets lower and lower, and the residents are fighting among themselves over where they're going to cut water use. You know, you, Steve, you can only have a 5-minute shower, no swimming pool, no flower bed, no beer brewing, no lawns. You know, we have to get austere here. But meanwhile, upstream, all the water, huge amounts of the water is being diverted to two mansions that have, like, private water parks for their kids. And the U.S. media just seems to be focused on the austerity in the village and not on the water parks up the stream.
Well, I want to make an historical point here. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, a time of rising U.S. prosperity, you find that the marginal income tax rates were far higher, up to 90%, and that it was a time when the corporate share of federal taxes approached 30% of the total. Today, tax rates on the wealthy are a fraction of what they were, and corporations bear somewhere south of 10% of the federal tax burden, meaning that we all pay more of it. Why do you think this history, and indeed the very subject of raising taxes, especially on corporations and the wealthy, is so absent from the media discussion? Is it simply a matter that these are the bosses' papers and TV stations?
I don't know. I think partly it's complicated by math and the fact that the tax system is kind of complicated. So if I were to tell you in 1955 that the richest 1% of households paid an effective tax rate of about 50%, meaning half of their income went to taxes of various kinds, and today that richest 1%, you know, households with incomes over $400,000, they're paying an effective tax rate now of about 18%. So they've seen their real bite, their tax, the percentage of their income going to taxes go down by more than half. There's a lot of math involved in that, in trying to explain that. But that's, I would say, it's partly that the media hasn't done a good job telling the story of what's happened over the last 30 years, the shift in tax responsibilities off of the wealthy onto the middle class, off of big corporations, onto small businesses. That's a really important story to be told.
We've been speaking with Chuck Collins, the co-founder of U.S. Uncut, a network working to stop corporate tax dodging, and the co-author with Bill Gates Sr. of Wealth and Our Commonwealth. You can read Collins' column, Pay Up, Corporate Tax Dodgers, at the Huffington Post. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Chuck Collins.
Thank you, Steve.
That some corporate media outlets now profess outright surprise to discover labor activism in the U.S., and not just that, but public support for labor activism, is a sign of many things, not least how disconnected those elite media are from working communities in this country, past and present. It seems clear that were it left to big media, the public protests in Wisconsin, the issues they raise, and the solidarity they've sparked would not have caught fire the way that it has. Does that make it a kind of defining moment for the growing but struggling independent press in this country? How are independent outlets coming at this story differently, and what should we be learning about media and social activism? We're joined now by telephone by Laura Flanders. She's host and founder of Grit TV, as well as an author, journalist, and activist. Listeners may also know her as the longtime host and producer of Counterspin. Welcome back to Counterspin, Laura Flanders.
Oh, it's so fun to be with you, Janine.
Well, we talked last week about the myths being broadcast by elite media about Wisconsin, some of them, of overpaid public workers, of the $3.6 billion deficit, of a public that's hostile to public workers. It's hard not to notice that even the laziest consumer of so-called alternative media, Grit TV, Democracy Now!, The Nation, The Huffington Post, any one of a number of blogs, would have heard those myths, as it were, instantly and thoroughly debunked. Is this the sort of story that defines the value of non-corporate-owned media? And does it matter that it doesn't yet seem to be derailing that elite media narrative?
Well, I think one of the things we learned last week is while the media had led some people to believe that if vast numbers of public protesters show up and occupy public space to resist government they think is oppressive, media from the corporate sort will not necessarily show up. I mean, the more people stayed in Tahrir Square in Cairo, the more media attention they got, the longer protesters stayed out there in occupation of their state house in Madison, the more media left the scene. I mean, I'll tell you, we went at Grit TV a week back when the protests had begun. We went back to Madison this weekend because we felt that no one else was there. This is a story that, you're absolutely right, has shown independent media at their best, partly because we knew exactly immediately beforehand some of the context in which this battle is playing out, some of its importance, and some of its consequences to the nation. All things, I think, which mostly the for-profit media left out.
Well, and in fact, I read a piece from the website The All where the reporter was actually describing CNN reporters who, even when they were there in Madison, seemed to be pointedly ignoring some of what was going on, in this case, a solidarity protest from police. So even when they're there physically, they can somehow not be covering the story.
You know, there was an extraordinary moment, Janine, this week on MSNBC when I think it was Lawrence O'Donnell had one of the very good state assembly people, Corey Mason from Madison, speaking with a state senator on the Republican side, Glenn Gromfman, I think is his name. And Glenn referred to those who were occupying the state house as slobs. He said, these aren't firemen and teachers, they're slobs, and they're making the place smell, and that's why, after all these centuries of historical tradition in Wisconsin, we have to close the state house to the public. Now, I thought, sitting in my room, having just left the scene, if only MSNBC had what you might call a reporter who could, instead of being on the far end of a telephone satellite in Washington or in New York, be right there in Madison, they could have gone inside the building, inhaled, talked to people, and proven or disproven the validity of what that state senator was saying. I mean, we were inside, and we saw who was there. He wants to call them slobs. I saw moms with their kids, children, I mean, under 10. I saw firefighters, sanitation workers. And in the center of the square, in the center of the rotunda, you would have an ongoing public speak out where people said who they were, and you would have a sanitation worker to stand up, or somebody who said in my presence, I'm a snowplow driver, and the whole place erupts in cheers. I mean, the scene is something that I hope we successfully brought to the public, even through, you know, in, out, and around, and beside, and between, in the gaps left by the corporate media. I hope we were able to give people a sense of what was going on there, because it was certainly something, it is still certainly something to be so proud of.
Well, one of corporate media's frames on this story is that it's Governor Walker versus the Democrats. There's kind of this allergy to acknowledging the leaderless public, if you will, the people themselves. That's something that seems categorically different about your show and others. The definition of who gets to be considered a social actor and who gets to be an expert on something.
No, it's a very good point. I mean, frankly, on the ground in this fight, the people who are the experts are the people who've actually looked at what this budget repair bill would entail, who've looked since at what the budget brings, which is one of the state senators, those living outside of the state right now called it on our show with 114 pages of devastation to where she lives. Those are the folks who really know how this is going to go down. And repeatedly, they would say to other reporters and us, you know, this is not just about this whole question of collective bargaining and union rights. It's also about the tax breaks that were given to corporations, $140 million worth last year, right before the governor declared a $137 million deficit for fiscal 12. It's also about Badger Care, which is the state health care program. The changes that he would push through would affect some 63,000 recipients of that critical health care program. They also said, you know, this didn't just start now. we've been a state of experimentation for the right, whether it was the Bradley Foundation funding the assault on welfare or the Koch brothers now funding, and among other things, an assault on the right of public workers' unions to negotiate on the part of workers, or on the right of legislators to put laws on the books forcing mining corporations to prove the, you know, healthfulness of their program before they're given the right to go ahead and do those mines. So Wisconsin has been a test case for left and right. It has some of the best law in the nation. This, in particular, I'm thinking of a mining moratorium law that went into effect years back. Koch and their fellows have had their eyes on that law. There are open pit mines they want to open in the top of the state. All of this stuff is at stake, and that's what just about anybody you would talk to on the ground would say, whether they were economists or academics or just moms and pops. They know what's at stake here, and they've seen it coming over decades. They also have a personal connection, many of them, to the movements in that state, whether they were the anti-war movements or the labor movement. AFSCME, the Public Employees Union, had its founding there in Wisconsin. The tradition of progressivism, Bob La Follette, people trace their sense of resistance back to Fighting Bob of 100 years ago. They have a sense of their state as a battleground, which I think is something the corporate media missed. Not just the sort of the cash that we've talked about, getting the facts wrong, or the context that there has been some background here, but the consequences for the nation, in many ways, as so goes Wisconsin, so go the rest of us.
We've been speaking with Laura Flanders. She's the founder and host of Grit TV. You can follow their coverage of, among other things, the ongoing public protests against attacks on public workers and the poor at grittv.org. Laura Flanders, thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
So great to be with you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. And that's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.